Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta. Courtney Hameister has struggled with anxiety and obsessive-compulsive disorder for a long time. Her OCD is known as harm-focused. People with this condition convince themselves they've done something terrible, even though they haven't. Courtney writes about her mental health struggles in a memoir called Okay, Fine, Whatever, The Year I Went From Being Afraid of Everything to Only Being Afraid of Most Things. Courtney hosted the syndicated public radio variety show Livewire for several years. But one night in 2013, something happened.
Whenever we would do a show, on the Monday before the show and the writers' meetings, we would have a show on a Saturday. So on that Monday, what I called my dread ball would arrive. And it would be this, about the size of a golf ball, maybe. And then as the week progressed, my dread ball would grow and it would sort of push out my breath, because that's what happens a lot when you have anxieties. You can't take a deep breath and it feels like something's blocking your lungs. And then by the Saturday, I would sort of be inside of the dread ball. Like it was this giant hamster ball I was walking around in, and it really dulls your vision of the world, and it dulls your ability to take in information and to put out information, because you've got this white noise essentially in your brain. And so it was really an unmanageable situation. But it wasn't until this show, it was our 9th anniversary show, that 2 days before, I just started having a massive OCD slash panic attack. You know, the standard stuff. I was afraid that I was going to hurt my housemate, and I was walking around in sort of constant panic. And I had never not been able to host a show. And I just thought, I still have to do it. And the script was all written. I called my brother and I went over to talk to him. And I had been saying, you know, I have to do this. I have all these people counting on me, the audience, the whole staff of the show. And we have all these stations that we're on.
Yeah.
And my brother is this wonderful, just very straightforward, very kind, but very straightforward person. You know, when you're talking to someone and they kind of tilt your head and they squint at you a little bit and you just know, oh, God. It's coming, right?
Yeah.
And he just gave me this look that really said, it's super adorable that you think you're this important, but it's going to be okay and the world's going to keep turning and you need to call your producer. And so I called our producer, Robin Tenenbaum, and I said, I can't do it. I can't do the show. And weirdly, or I think maybe not weirdly or not coincidentally, we were having Luke Burbank on the show, who hosts a podcast still called TBTL.
Too Beautiful to Live.
Exactly. And we were having him on for the express purpose of seeing if he could back me up, because we didn't have any backup for me if I ever got sick and it was recorded in front of a live audience. And so I called our producer and I said, let's see if Luke will host it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he did. And an amazing and terrible thing happened, and that was that the show was great, and he was great, and it sort of went off, I would say not without a hitch, but it was a good show. He did a great job, and so I realized that this thing that I had helped make, that I loved, and I believed I was such a huge part of, could absolutely survive without me, and that was really wonderful, and it was awful.
Yeah, at the same time, it's tough because you were a big part of it. You'd been doing it for 10 years, and then you continued to work on the show.
Yeah.
Except you just didn't host, but you were writing and producing and supervising writers. And then you came up with the OK, Fine, Whatever project. What was the origin story for the OFW project?
Well, I think that I realized what I had lost. There are myriad reasons why it took me 9 years to leave this thing that was so unhealthy for me. I think that a huge part of it was that these people that I so respected saw me as a peer. And for someone who has massive imposter syndrome, that was a huge help and amazing. And I also was able to meet people like Gus Van Sant and Carrie Brownstein and Mike Birbiglia and Tig Notaro and Maria Bamford, these people that I thought were so incredibly talented. And I got to ask them how they did what they did. And I got to try to get inside their brains. And that to me was this extraordinary gift. And I think that it was so hard for me to leave for all those reasons. And so once I did leave, I realized that I had lost this beautiful thing, this wonderful thing that so few people get the opportunity to do. And I didn't want to lose anything like that again. And I thought, is there a way I can train my brain like you would a child? Like take a child out into the world and say, this is here to hurt you, and this is here for fun. This is here for your edification and to make your life richer, because anxious brains really sometimes have trouble differentiating between those two things.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I thought, what if I just did a lot of things that might scare me a little bit, because I'd obviously pushed my boundaries too far by doing Livewire for so long. What if I did smaller things? And then once my brain realized that everything was okay, anxiety turns you into a pessimist.
Yes.
Anxiety just digs these ruts in your neural pathways that are so difficult to get out of. That just say, you think about doing something and your brain immediately goes to, it's not going to work, or here are the 12 terrible things that are going to happen, you know, right?
Yeah, exactly.
This is what anxiety does to you. And I didn't think that I would turn into an optimist. I really would have loved to, but I just thought maybe I cannot think that everything's going to be terrible.
So how did you decide which experiences to try, which experiences would make you the most uncomfortable?
Well, that's the thing. I absolutely didn't want things that actually put me in physical peril, because I knew that that was way beyond my comfort zone. Mm-hmm. If my comfort zone was in Oregon, I didn't want to go all the way over to New York. I wanted to be actually maybe around Wisconsin, frankly, right?
Yeah.
So I wanted sort of Wisconsin-y experiences. So it was things that, you know, when you think about an experience, you look at what it feels like in your body when you think about doing it, right?
Yeah.
Do I start to feel a little bit of that buzzing in my chest? A little bit of that buzzing in my chest was fine. I just didn't want something that would actually start to trigger panic, you know, when I just thought about doing it. I knew that was unhealthy.
Yeah, fair enough.
So it was that kind of stuff. I went to a sensory deprivation tank. I went to a professional cuddler. There was a huge dating component of it because I was on this massive dating binge. I did speed dating, which was terrible for me. I mean, it was 18 strangers, and that's the funny thing. It was terrible in its own way, but it was also absolutely fascinating to just get a five-minute window into 18 different people's lives in a matter of, you know, a couple of hours.
Yeah, it's good time management.
Exactly.
So, not including the dating, which I want to get to in a moment, of the other experiences, what was the most, as you would say, relatively dangerous experience that you took that made the biggest difference, that was the most successful in terms of helping you get out of your comfort zone?
Oh, I would say the cuddler for sure. The professional cuddler. I went to Samantha Hess here in Portland, who's gotten a lot of national attention. And it was the one that I approached with the most trepidation, for sure, because I don't want to talk to strangers. So cuddling with a stranger sounded like the third or fourth circle of hell. I don't know where that would land exactly.
I just had this thought that what you could have done, which maybe both you and I would find even more frightening, was you could have done phone cuddling, like cuddle with a stranger and the stranger's on the phone. So
with you.
Yeah, with you.
You're
yeah, they're on the phone.
Yeah,
exactly. There you go. Talking to each other in your cell phone. Yeah.
You've just got to order a pizza with
yeah,
them.
Yeah, you have to.
You know? It's like, just get it done. You can do this. But that's the thing. It's like, we can order online now. So I feel like that's a skill that we don't need to.
That's right.
Foster. Yeah. But I think that when people hear professional cuddler, they immediately click into the snark part of their brain.
Mm-hmm.
And I completely understand why that is. I can understand why people wouldn't trust it. They would think there must be a sexual aspect to it. Because the idea of needing someone like that is so intensely vulnerable.
Yeah.
And that is part of the reason why I was trepidatious about it, was that I have been single for the majority of my adult life, and I felt so much shame around that, and I felt so much shame around how much I needed to be touched. I mean, I used to do breath work mm-hmm. for Livewire to sort of calm me down.
Oh, right, sure.
And I remember lying on the floor with the person that I was working with, and she touched my hand, and she was sort of holding my hand, and I started crying because no one had touched me for so long. I needed touch so much.
Yeah.
And it was sort of the realization, and there's something so poignant about getting the kind of touch that Samantha offers when it's not real, and I know that it's real, right? She's actually sitting there. But when it's not a person in your life that's doing it because they care about you, so you're getting this thing that you need so much, but at the same time, it's this incredible reminder that you're not getting what you want in your life. I think that seeing her made me realize that there's not something wrong with me because I want physical affection and I need it. I'm just human. I'm just a human being.
As you mentioned, the OK Fine Whatever project involved a lot of dating, and you came up with a very creative way to keep track of your dates. Can you tell me about that?
So you just want, you want your listeners to hate me?
No, I don't. No, that's not something that makes you worthy of hate. It's interesting. And it's a great insight into your mind. You're kidding.
Yeah, I'm kidding. Yeah. I created a spreadsheet. And it was really because I'm not great at this. And I had done so little of it in my life. I'd had two significant relationships in my life that had really only lasted. One lasted 2 years and one lasted a few months. And I never really dated. They were people that I kind of met through other people. And so I thought, if I approach this scientifically, then my brain's not going to fail me or my heart's not going to be quite as involved. I'm going to be a scientist about this and just kind of look at the facts and the numbers. I had all these categories like my attraction to him, his attraction to me. One of them was loves to talk about ideas, has a job he's passionate about. And I actually, a couple months into it, I put has a car. And you're like, yeah. I think you got 1 point for a car and 0 points for not a car. Great conversation was one. And so I rated people from 1 to 10. I'm so sorry, but I did in all of these categories. But, you know, as a person who's probably dated people, there are some categories that count significantly more than other categories.
Oh, yeah.
Like, has a car is a million times less important than great conversation.
Yeah.
You know, easy conversation or loves to talk about ideas or whatever. This is for me, right?
Right. For someone who lives in Los Angeles, having a car might be among the most important things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And, you know, having a job at a studio that I can take advantage of is also somewhere on that list, probably.
Exactly. So you dated many men. Did you ever find true love?
In the book, I just sort of refer to the guys oftentimes as a number because I had 28 first dates that year.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I just kind of, this was first date number 7 and then sort of what ended up happening with him. And I went on maybe over a little over 100 dates for the whole year because I would have ensuing dates with some of these people.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of mine wrote me on Facebook and said, oh, my gosh, I just finished the book, and I really enjoyed it. And also, it's a love story.
Yeah.
I hadn't thought of it, but, yeah, I did end up falling in love with someone. That's the thing. You know, I wanted to be clear with this friend. I said, but just to be clear, me falling in love with someone was not sort of the happy ending of the book because, as we all know, falling in love with someone is not a happy ending. It's the beginning of, you know, and especially in a book that's sort of about trying to figure out your stuff. And since I've been in so few relationships, this really helped me realize, oh, now I have someone that I love and I'm an anxious person. That means I have got to figure out not how to fix all of this stuff about me that drives me crazy, how to change the way that I think about those things, because I will drive myself crazy thinking that I have all of these things that are broken about me, and these are all the reasons he's going to fall out of love with me. That's where you really start doing the work, not in making yourself lovable, but in recognizing that you are lovable as a broken person and that you're working on it and you're human. That's really where the work begins. As everyone knows, you know, who's been in a lot of relationships, but I hadn't. So I was learning that like a freaking high schooler, you know.
Yeah. Did this guy score high on the spreadsheet, or were you not using the spreadsheet anymore at that point?
You know, I was, because I used it all year. And that's the thing. It's like, and that was part of the reason why I recognized. And I knew kind of along the way, this is just something that a villain in a John Hughes film would do. This isn't great, but it's not until someone that you truly care about is on the spreadsheet and you're looking at the numbers that you assigned to him when you first met him that you really feel like a jerk. And he was on there and he scored very high, but he wasn't the number one.
Yeah.
But this is the thing. Anybody scores high on a spreadsheet if you don't know anything about them. You know?
Yeah,
like,
good point.
Yeah, if someone presents themselves to you, I think that the guy who scored the highest was a guy that I never saw again. He was this guy that his job was to climb the largest trees in Oregon and measure them.
Lumberjack guy.
Exactly. The fact that I gave him the highest score was the dumbest thing in the world because it had to do with his job. He was fun to talk to and fascinating. But when I thought about it, it was like, I am not outdoorsy in the least. And his photos on OkCupid were him at the top of trees. And one of the photos was him attached with carabiners to the side of a cliff because he was camping that night, off the side of a cliff.
Wow.
My worst nightmare was his vacation. Of course we weren't compatible. No. So this spreadsheet idea was completely broken, but he did score very high. Mm-hmm.
For those of our listeners who may find themselves struggling with these kind of issues, with anxiety mm-hmm. and OCD, what advice would you give them?
I believed that sort of becoming more adventurous and it's not going to kill you was sort of a muscle, right? Mm-hmm. And I found that the more that I did it, the more comfortable that I got doing it. And that's a lot to ask somebody who's anxious, but I would say that that worked for me. But also, at the same time, I was going to someone, and not really at the same time, it was toward the end, I started going to a therapist who really started to teach me mindfulness. And what I would say is I find breathing magical. So get an app, something like the Calm app. The Calm app has this very simple, just part of the app that all it is just this little circle, and it just shows you to breathe. And you just watch it, and it just, you breathe in when it shows you to breathe in, and you breathe out when it shows you to breathe out. And people say, don't tell me to breathe. It's, you know, they think it's woo-woo.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
not. It's science. When you breathe deeply into your diaphragm and those muscles push out in your belly, there are chemicals that are released that tell your brain that everything's okay. So I would say that. I would say breathe. And mindfulness, the reason that we are anxious is that we are freaked out and full of shame about past mistakes that we made that we can't let go of, and we are terrified of the future. We are living in the past and the future, and it is driving us crazy, literally. And what mindfulness does is it forces you to just be in the present moment and look at what is in front of me right now, and can I deal with that?
Somewhere in between.
Courtney Hameister is the author of Okay, Fine, Whatever, The Year I Went From Being Afraid of Everything to Only Being Afraid of Most Things. You can find out more about Courtney's story at wpr.org/beta.
The thing that satisfies me most as a unified theory is just the idea that there's an evolutionary reason, maybe, for comedy, that our primate ancestors needed to find it pleasurable when they found some little absurdity or incongruity in life, and then they solved the problem.
Up next, Jeopardy! Champion Ken Jennings explains how comedy conquered our culture. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio.